Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch. Welcome to another edition of New Netherland Praatjes. We are coming to you today from beautiful downtown Rensselaer, New York. And we are at Crailo State Historic Site. And our guest today is Heidi Hill, who is the site manager of Crailo and also of Schuyler Flats. Heidi, welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Russell.
My first question is, how many people who come here, their first question is, what is the word Crailo and where does that come from?
Almost everyone asks that question. And we have a ready answer. Crailo means crow's wood, and it comes from the Van Rensselaer estate in the Netherlands. And they felt that it was a suitable name here. Crailo in the green bush.
Well, you brought up the Van Rensselaers, which was basically going to be my second question. Give us the background of who these people were who dug the foundation for this house.
Sure. Well, the Van Rensselaers were entrepreneurs. Killian Van Rensselaer was a jeweler in Amsterdam. He had two sons.
This is in the 17th century.
He sent two sons to New Netherland in 1630 to oversee his patroonship. The Dutch West India Company had been here for quite some time trading with the Native Americans for furs. But because the Hudson River is a vulnerable travel route, because it connects the Atlantic Ocean to, well, today another country, but certainly other world powers to the north, they wanted to ensure a foothold here for the Dutch. And they saw the best way to do that by giving patroonships to wealthy landowners who could afford to settle the land, really attract farmers to the land, and create a settlement. And this settlement became Rensselaerswyck. So Jeremias Van Rensselaer and his older brother, Jan Baptiste Van Rensselaer, were here in their 20s, really, very young men, running a patroonship.
And it's an interesting thing, I think, to try to comprehend about the way the colony of New Netherland was settled by the Dutch, that it was the Dutch Golden Age. So it was kind of difficult to get settlers to come here, whereas in England, this is the era of the English Civil Wars, and lots of people wanted to leave England. Mm-hmm. So New England was getting population, and so this system of patroonships was a way to get a wealthy person to sort of take claim of an area of land and then be responsible for bringing settlers.
Yes.
And the Van Rensselaer, or Rensselaerswyck, was really the only successful one. It was the only one that actually worked. Would you say that's fair?
Yes, I would say that's fair. And it was the most northern patroonship, certainly closer to the Native American trade coming from the north. The Van Rensselaers early on were trading with the Mohican Indians, but the Iroquois, who were really settled deeper into the interior, were often the ones gathering the furs and bringing them to the river for the trade for the Dutch. And they really didn't want to go through the Mohican Indians, an Algonquin group. And so these people, the Iroquois and the Mohican, two different nations, were often warring with one another, not just because of the trade, but also because they were very different from one another. And so the Iroquois eventually pushed the Mohicans to the east into what now is Massachusetts.
And to set the scene a little bit further, we've got this Dutch colony of New Netherland, which goes from here or north of here all the way not just to Manhattan, but all the way down to the Delaware River. And in this region, the second city, Beverwijk, and you have the fort, the Dutch fort, Fort Orange, on the other side of the river.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the patroonship of Rensselaerswyck and its relationship to Beverwijk into New Netherland.
Sure. Well, the Rensselaer's patroonship was just under 1 million acres. And
which is an enormous amount of
land. It's enormous, yes. And they settled on, the land and really felt that this area, Rensselaer, would become the center of the community. They developed mills on the Red Mill Creek, and they set up craftsmen. There were breweries, and they really felt this would be the heart of Rensselaerswyck. But a community grew up around Fort Orange in the 17th century because Peter Stuyvesant claimed quite a lot of land around that fort for the Dutch West India Company. And that is really where the settlement grew strongest and became Beverwijk.
Right, which then becomes Albany. So
yes.
Okay, so that's the backstory. That's the Kilian van Rensselaer and then his sons he sends in. Kilian, by the way, never actually came here himself.
Right.
And then let's get to the founding of this house or the first house on this site.
Sure. Well, Jeremias van Rensselaer did create a building on the site that Krylo sits on today, and it was much smaller than what we have.
And this is not a huge house.
No, it's not. No, it's not. But it was probably a one-room home with a loft and a foundation. And there's some thought that it housed the first Dutch domine or minister of the colony. I should say, of Rensselaerswyck, Domine Megapolensis. We have stones in the basement that date to the 17th century. And he did rent a building from the Van Rensselaers that burned down in the 17th century. We do have evidence, archaeological evidence, of burned window glass in that very early settlement period. So we do know that a building here did burn down, and so many historians and archaeologists connect Domine Megapolensis with this building, this early building. So that was in the 1660s, and it was rebuilt in the 17th century. We have all sorts of evidence in the documents of Jeremias rebuilding the building, and so we match the archaeology, that evidence, with the documents, and that way we can come up with a story of Krylo back in the 17th century, 350 years ago. The house was greatly expanded and built upon again by Jeremias's son, Hendrik. Hendrik was not the eldest son, and so he did not get the patroonship, but he was given 1,500 acres here in the Greenbush, and also given ownership of a large tract of land, the Lower Manor, in today's Claverick, Columbia County.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he's really the one that we associate. In other words, Kilian van Rensselaer's grandson, we associate with Krylo as a house that a family lived in originally.
Correct. When I worked here in the 1980s, we thought for sure that we knew that that house built by Hendrik was built in 1704 because he was amassing large quantities of brick and wood at that point. But it really wasn't until 1707 that this house was built. And we know that because Cornell University came here in 2007 and took samples of the beams in the building, mm-hmm. Core samples, dendrochronology, and they were able to match the growth rings exactly with growth rings from timbers in Boston. Boston has a huge database of buildings from that time period. And I wouldn't have believed it until I saw it, but you could see that these trees were growing exactly alike because of the weather patterns mm-hmm. In the early 18th century. And so they could tell that these beams in this house were cut in the spring of 1707.
Wow, that precise.
That yeah. precise, yes. And so we have a definite date now.
Uh-huh. And why exactly this location? What was special about this? I mean, obviously, we're right on the river.
Right on the river. And the river came much closer to the building in the 17th century. It wasn't until the late 19th century and early 20th century that the Army Corps of Engineers dug a very deep, narrow shipping channel and really took the sludge from the river and put it onto the sides of the river and made it much narrower. And so our park that we have across the street was once all river, and now
that's landfill.
It's made, yes, it's landfill. But this place was a very strategic place, even for Native Americans. There was a settlement here prior to the Dutch coming up the river. Mohican Indians lived here because it was in close proximity to the Normanskill across the river, and an island in the river that became known as Castle Island. And this became a meeting place for Native Americans and trade before Europeans were trading with them. It was natural for the Dutch in 1614 to build their first fort on Castle Island, and that was Fort Nassau. It was a very fertile island because many springs it was flooded from the snow melt, and the Dutch found out very quickly it wasn't the perfect place for a fort because it was often washed away. So in the 1620s, that location of a fort was abandoned, and they moved on to the mainland just a little bit north on the other side of the river, and that was Fort Orange in 1624.
So they were originally, I mean, the logic behind this location is you were right across the river from what was the original fort, and this was this Indian crossroads of trade.
Yes, the Normanskill was very important. It was a foot route for Native Americans, and it was perfect location.
Right. How long was it? Was this house used as a home?
Oh, for a very long time. So that began in 1707 for this Crilo building, and the family lived here until the 1870s, or at least they owned it until the 1870s. In about the 1850s, they rented it to tenants, and it became actually, in that time period, a school for boys, the Mansion Hall School.
Hmm. And it became a state historic site when?
1924. And it's saving as sort of an iconic Dutch house began in the late 19th century. It was going to be torn down because a person who was in the ice business lived behind it. And it was dilapidated, falling down. And his livelihood was in the river.
On the river. So in other words, he wanted to tear it down so he could just get to the...
Have free access
get his ice to
the river.
The river, or
right.
Vice versa, yeah.
It was in the way.
Yeah.
Susan Delancey Van Rensselaer Strong, a descendant living in New Jersey at the time, was visiting and learned of this, and she wanted to purchase the place. She convinced him to hold off and appealed to the Daughters of the American Revolution and the Colonial Dames and other groups that she belonged to help save the place. And she did raise some money, not enough though, so she finally bought it outright. Her husband and his family, they were quite wealthy in New Jersey, and so she purchased the place, again tried to repair it, restore it. And when she finally decided that she didn't have enough resources to do that, she sold it to the state in 1924.
So then as of 1924, it became what kind of historic site? What was the character of it?
Well, under the Education Department and during the colonial revival period, when people were celebrating the revolution, it really became a house to celebrate the colonial period, starting with the revolution, but looking back to the Dutch colonial period. And so it was shown as a Dutch house, as well as they knew that at that point. You know, certainly colonialized.
Period furnishings.
Period furnishings, mm-hmm. Yes.
And I assume there are pictures of the house from that era.
There are. There were circular grates that you could step into in each doorway to prevent you from going into the room, uh-huh. But you could look at the room display,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there was usually a label.
Sure. And then it became, when did it change from that into something like what it is today.
Right. Well, with the Preservation Act in the late 1960s, this place was transferred to a new entity. It was always under the Education Department, and then the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation was developed. And People's Island in Waterford, New York, was really the center for historic preservation for New York State at that point. And this house was then under the auspices of that entity. Mm-hmm. And the exhibits changed from the period home, from rooms that you could look at, to more of an exhibit type with labels and information.
Mm-hmm. So you brought us to the 60s. And in the 70s, I think, is the crucial period for transformation of understanding of the Albany region's origins, and that in many ways has to do with the excavation of Fort Orange. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and its relationship to Coelho.
Yes, exactly. Well, under that People's Island umbrella, there were archaeologists. And one of those archaeologists, Paul Huey, who I think you've interviewed in the past, really made his career on the discovery of a little sliver of that original Fort Orange. Construction was being done on 787 and a railroad way between the north and southbound routes of 787. And the backhoe dipped in and found all sorts of artifacts from the 17th century. And that construction crew stopped immediately. They knew to stop. And the archaeologists were brought in and had several months to excavate that site. It was during the winter, so it was under harsh conditions, but they excavated many, many artifacts, I think, you know, up to 200,000 artifacts. And that discovery really started a whole new chapter in the story of the Dutch colonial period here. We really awakened to the life of these people here in the 1600s, and that enabled us to tell a better story. We had documents that were translated, but in the 1970s too, Charlie Gehring started translating those again and translating more documents. And so the combination of those two activities happening in the 1970s just opened up a whole new story for us. And Coelho is really based on that discovery of Fort Orange, as well as the better translations of the Dutch documents mm-hmm, here.
Mm-hmm. So it's part of this new foundation of awareness among people in the region of the Dutch origins.
Yes, for sure.
Do most people who come to the house, most tourists who come to visit, are they from the region?
No. You know, we do hold festival days, and certainly we get a lot of the community for those. But we have regional travelers. We have travelers from, you know, the New England states. We joke that, you know, many of our travelers are from Wisconsin, it seems.
You mean sort of Midwestern Dutch people?
Yes, Midwestern. Or? They come across those northern states land here in Albany and are fascinated by this story. Mm-hmm. So it's a very new story for many of our visitors.
Sure, sure. And how about for you? How did you get here?
Well, after my time at Binghamton.
You studied history undergraduate and then museum studies as a graduate,
yes.
As a master's.
And I was here for over a year before I went to that master's degree program at Cooperstown.
Okay.
And when I landed at Cooperstown, I think my classmates and my teachers grew tired of hearing me talk about the 17th century. Mm-hmm. I was just fascinated about this time period. It just was such a new discovery, mm-hmm. and it seemed that there was so much more information to be mined, and mm-hmm. I really believe there still is. Mm-hmm. And there are new ways of looking at this information. Since it is so fresh, new scholars are looking at the information in different ways all the time, and it's just really a treasure trove. Mm-hmm.
So you had told me before that you grew up, I guess you always had an interest in history, but it was European history originally.
That's correct. That was my focus at Binghamton.
Because you always kind of, or often people want to look, especially when you're young, you want to look elsewhere for whatever it is.
And I think that's a good foundation to have, especially when you land at a museum like this and you're interpreting, you know, colonial history, the history of Europeans really transplanted.
And you originally came here, you worked as a guide.
Yes.
In 1985, 86?
86 and 87. Uh-huh. A guide, a lawnmower. I was out trimming trees. Yes, it was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. And you were here for what, a year or two?
A little bit over a year, yes, before I went to graduate school.
Then you went to graduate school. Mm-hmm. What did you do after that?
I went to work at the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport, Connecticut, circus museum.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Different kind of history, colorful history.
Yeah, and then came back to New York State to work at Olana for 8.5 years.
Uh-huh. And then in 2005, you
landed
returned here.
Back at Crailo. Mm-hmm. I never knew that I'd be coming back. And I opened the door and I could still smell that wonderful smoky smell and felt that I was home again.
Right.
We do hearth cooking demonstrations in our kitchen cellar. Uh-huh. And, you know, everyone that comes in the building remarks on that, the smell of the place.
Mm-hmm. You said before that when you... you were here, there was a main exhibit that was here when you were a guide in the 80s. And when you came back in 2005, it was still the main exhibit.
Yes, it was still the same exhibit 25 years later.
So I guess your first order of business was maybe we should kind of refurbish the exhibit?
Yes, this place really was a sleepy kind of place because the building evolved and had so many iterations. You know, it wasn't a pristine restoration here that some of our colleagues appreciate. And so Crailo tended to be ignored a little bit. And we felt that the upcoming quadricentennial, the celebration of Henry Hudson coming up the river in 1609, which was happening in 2009, was the perfect opportunity for Crailo to shine. And so we rebranded the place. We had a new logo. We now called ourselves the Museum of the Colonial Dutch in the Hudson River Valley. We developed a new exhibit. And really, because of the compelling story we had to tell, we brought along a lot of supporters on the way. You know, we had 3 years to prep for 2009. And so we worked diligently to tell the story, connect with partners, and really sing its praises loud.
And so this new exhibit came into being in 2009. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. We had great support from our agency. And because I was able to raise money through grant writing to foundations and corporations and other donations, the state felt that they really needed to put some money behind this project, which was great. One of the quotes was, "We can't have Henry Hudson coming up the river in 2009 and nothing to show for it at Crailo."
Right. So that was the impetus to rebuild, to come up with a new exhibit for the quadricentennial of Hudson's voyage.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we did even more.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of money are we talking about?
Oh, well, you know, we do things on the cheap when you work for New York State. And so we did all of our own research and our grant writing and exhibit development, image development. We obtained some money to purchase rights and reproductions through a foundation. We also raised money for the technology pieces of the exhibit through the Capital Region Area Foundation, the Bender Foundation, Family Foundation. I think all told, it was probably less than $400,000, and that's for the exhibit, for building restoration, for landscaping, for publications that we did, for a film that we won 2 National Cine Awards for, and more.
Mm-hmm. And when people come today, what can they see?
They can see and do all sorts of things. We have an exhibit that really helps interpret why the Dutch left the Netherlands to in search of resources around the world, how they became very patriotic and nationalistic and settled different regions. We are based on archaeology, so we have all sorts of archaeological fragments, but with those we place the actual whole object as well, and then genre paintings so you can see those objects in use.
Mm-hmm.
There are all sorts of things to find out on your own as well. You can discover through some low-tech pieces in the exhibit components, answers to questions that you might have about navigation, about Henry Hudson's voyage up the river and back down. We have information about the Native American trade with all sorts of hands-on objects. And, you know, they can really see a European culture transferred here to a community on the edge of wilderness. So it's very interesting.
And it strikes me that there are really two things, two components to it, one being the exhibits, the mm-hmm. that content, and the other content is the house itself as an artifact, but it's a little tricky to kind of unpack it because it, you know, people think, oh, a house is from 1720. That means right. This is all from 1720, when in fact it was constantly being picked at or reworked and rebuilt completely. And what help do people have when they are here to try to understand what they're looking at in terms of the house itself?
Well, we give people options when they come, and visitors always have questions about the family that lived here and the building that they're seeing. And so we give guided tours. We answer those questions. We can focus in different areas. We certainly take our cues from the visitors and determine what they're interested in and take it from there.
Mm-hmm.
We've had cell phone tours that focus on the architecture of the building. We have had pamphlets as well. We sometimes have special open houses that focus on the family and the building. So we do a variety of things. We really try to work with people what visitors are looking for.
When you're looking at the house from the outside, it has this kind of fortress-like mm-hmm. feel to it.
It does.
And in fact, it was a quasi-military structure at different periods.
That's exactly right. And, you know, beginning in the 1600s, there was fear of attack, especially from the French and French and Indians. That continued into the 17th century, and archaeologists have determined, Paul Huey, in fact, with others who have worked with him, have determined that this place was palisaded over and over again.
Hmm.
So we have gun ports on the house.
Which you can see.
Some yeah. of which are still in the building that you can see, yes. And in 2007, they did find post holes very close to the building where there were palisades. There are also references in the Van Rensselaer papers that talk about, at one point, a Native American who was held captive here after an attack, and he escaped over the palisade wall. So that helps us determine the documents and the archaeology when there were palisades around the building.
You were showing me a little while ago a picture, a painting of from the other side of the river, of this side in the 1760s.
Yes.
And it looks so alone, so isolated, mm-hmm. the house.
Sure. It was on 1,500 acres.
Yeah.
And there were neighbors, to be sure, but
there
wasn't
right
a city. There wasn't a city around
right.
the building.
Right.
And, you know, there's lots of archaeology still around, probably under neighbors' yards. And, you know, any time the city needs to dig a trench or repave a road, we're right there, because any scrap of the 17th century evidence can really begin a whole new chapter in the story. So it's very important to...
Which leads me to ask about the artifacts themselves. Where do they come from? I mean, are they your own collection, or are they on loan from the State Museum, or...
We have only a couple things on loan, and the two that I'm thinking are from the Stone Fort in Schoharie, and that is a Matt Hook and Sith. But all of the archaeological evidence was excavated by our agency's archaeologists, Paul Huey leading that charge for the most part.
Our meaning...
The New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation.
Give them a plug.
Yes.
And some of it was excavated on site?
Yes. Mm-hmm. For instance, we have wampum in the trade room that came from the backyard. Mm-hmm. We don't have it on exhibit right now, but we also have this very rare pine tree shilling from the 1650s in our collection that was excavated from the backyard.
Pine tree, meaning with a picture of a pine tree.
It has a pine tree on one side. They were minted in New England, and they're quite rare.
Huh. What period was that? Do you know?
1654, I believe, is the date on it.
Very interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have read something about Yankee Doodle in this house.
Yes.
You want to tell us that story and tell
us how much
of a real story it is or apocryphal?
Well, we have family lore that says that a grandson during the French and Indian War witnessed Richard Shuckburg, the army surgeon, penning the words to Yankee Doodle in our backyard, Crailo's backyard, at a well. And that would have been in 1758. Now, Fort Ticonderoga has a document that puts Richard Shuckburg here in 1758. And he was amassing medical needs for the soldiers to go north. And so he was here. We know that the music existed prior to this time. It was just popular music. And it seems that it could be possible that he penned those words here when he was at Crailo.
And then do we know, have you followed it to the extent of like, well, when did it first appear? It must have been shortly thereafter.
It was during the French and Indian War here in America. This was a militia ground. It was a place to gather soldiers in order to go north. They kept them away from Albany because of the temptations of the taverns across the river. And also because... this was out of the eye of spies that would be coming from the north.
And at the same time, it was a substantial dwelling. It was a solid house.
And the Van Rensselaers were certainly the generals, the leaders of most war efforts. And so it was only natural that this become a militia ground. So it's likely that Richard Shuckburg wrote those words here because ragtag militia were coming in from the east, the New England states, and this is where they were gathering.
That's who he's referring to.
Yes.
This sounds like somebody must have done a dissertation on this or something like that.
Oh, many. I remember in the 1980s, there were people trying to prove that it was written here, and there is no hard and fast evidence. That's what we're lacking.
One of those.
We have
things,
the family lore. Mm-hmm. And that could have just been a story, but it could just as well have happened.
There's circumstantial evidence to support it.
Yes, exactly.
So talk about the house during the Revolution.
Again, it was used as an army hospital and a militia ground, a gathering place for soldiers. And just the same, it was where the soldiers were kept out of the eye of spies coming from the north, and so that they were kept away from... Albany.
The current exhibit is A Sweet and Alien Land?
Yes, this is our permanent exhibit. It's been here since 2009, and, you know, we're still working on it. these exhibits evolve. When we find that we're having a problem interpreting a certain area, we work with People's Island to resolve that problem. We also have a new exhibit, a special exhibit upstairs, A Dishonorable Trade, Human Trafficking in the Dutch Atlantic World. And we are now working with that exhibit and incorporating those themes and ideas here in the permanent exhibit on the first floor.
So, in other words, you have kind of a satellite exhibit that then feeds your main exhibit.
Yes. And because that satellite exhibit will travel eventually, we want to continue interpreting the themes from that exhibit in the permanent exhibit.
And how do the, maybe it's too broad a question, but how do ideas for the, that involved in the evolution of the exhibit emerge?
Well, they really emerge from the staff here. We're a very small staff.
How many people?
Well, because I'm shared with two sites and another person who's permanent is shared with two sites, there's a whole person, I suppose. We have about five.
Okay.
Yeah. But it varies at different times of the year when we're open or not.
And why don't you, while we're at it, tell us the hours?
Sure. We reopen May 11th this year, and we will be open Wednesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. until 5 p.m. The tours are on the hour, and the last tour starts at 4. And that's the same for our other site as well, Skyler Mansion.
For the tour, or can you just wander through the house yourself, or how does that work?
We're very flexible. Certainly, people come for the tour. We try to do things on the hour, but now because we have an additional exhibit, there will be additional time spent in the house.
Okay, you were telling me about the evolution of the exhibit. Staff contributes ideas?
Yes, we contribute ideas. We've had a variety of staff here, many of whom have gone through the SUNY Albany Public History Program. Some are master's degree students. Others are doctorate candidates. And they have interests, of course, and sometimes they are more privy to grants and opportunities that are coming along because they're tied into that academic community. And the exhibit that we have now, A Dishonorable Trade, happened because one staff member saw a grant offered by the Yale Public History Institute where you could apply to go there for a week and work with the Gilder Lehrman Center for Slavery, Abolition, and Resistance and develop a project. We wanted to do some sort of interpretation on Africans in the Dutch colony, and we thought what better way to do that than work with the history professors at Yale and other experts from the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture, the DuSable Museum, the Yale Art Museums, and so on. We didn't think we had a chance at all. And in my mind, that was a good thing because we had to send three of our five staff members to Yale in the middle of the summer, the height of tourism season, July. So I thought, well, we won't be chosen. And so
you don't have to worry about that
problem. Go ahead and apply. It'll be a good exercise.
Yeah.
We were chosen. We were one of five. We were the only northern site. We were the only 17th century site.
Right.
And we were there with the National Museum of Denmark, as well as some other East Coast museums. It was a wonderful experience.
So it was kind of a workshop. Within a week, you learned a lot and put together, developed the parameters for an exhibit.
Exactly. We had to go with an idea in mind. We had to have quite a lot of research done. We were assigned two graduate students, one who knew quite a bit about the Brazil Dutch colony, and they did research for us before we arrived at Yale. So when we landed in Yale, we hit the ground running, and our idea really evolved. we were going to focus just on New Netherland, and then we really decided we needed to tell a broader story about the Atlantic trade.
Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, these were not isolated. These colonies were not completely separate from each other, nor were they completely cut off from the home countries.
Exactly, exactly. It just became difficult to tell the story if we were only talking about New Netherland. And you know, our museum is really, if you look at it, a museum of trade. And so we needed to talk about the entire trade, not just the objects, but also the humans who were being traded between the different colonies.
Mm-hmm. It seems like right now there is a lot going on in the region in terms of appreciating the history and attention being put on it and on the city, and the mayor of Albany right now seems mm-hmm. very keen on it. Is that your sense? Do you collaborate a lot with other local organizations?
Definitely. Both Crailo and Schuyler Mansion belong to Partners for Albany Stories, and this is a group that really came out of the economic recession out of desperation. And there are 11 of us working together, and we have been since then on a regular basis. We work for grants together, but primarily we're trying to tell the story of Albany so that we can, you know, come up with broad themes that we can all work under and then collaborate under the same umbrella. So maybe two or three museums will work together on a project at a time, whereas we were going it alone in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's just been a wonderful collaboration.
And I understand there's now some project underway to identify, for example, the Palisades of the Fort in Albany and somehow mark that on the streets. So it seems like Kathy Sheehan, the mayor, mm-hmm. is...
Yes, she's very supportive of this. She has a committee for heritage tourism, and they've come out with a report. They're working closely with us, mm-hmm. and it's really been a really nice change.
And this has to do, I think, just making this up maybe, with the kind of identity of the region or its sense of itself.
Yes.
Yes,
the Albany Visitor Center is working as well on branding. You know, certainly it's no coincidence that this is also happening with the new convention center and how they're linking to the hotels. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really going to bring Albany to the forefront and make it a more appealing place to visit.
And how many visitors do you get here?
We get between 14,000 and 16,000 people a year. And remember, we're closed for much of that year.
Right,
so
right, right.
It's a pretty busy
thing. And you are on
the
other side of the river from a lot of these other...
Yes, we are. Of course, the Van Rensselaers thought that this was the side of the river that would be the center of
right.
Rensselaerswyck.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter Stuyvesant kind of... thwarted that effort.
Mm-hmm. And so the people who come here, are they often doing these sort of historical rounds of the area?
For sure. Mm-hmm. We get all sorts of people. We really get a high percentage of people from the Netherlands here at Crailo, huh. which is a lot of fun for us.
Yeah. Do you do any kind of advertising there or...
We don't. We don't. Of course, 2009 and the quadricentennial
right.
really helped
boost, yeah.
that effort. And that year we had more Dutch people than we'd ever seen here. When we interpret Piet Hein in the 1620s, they would all begin singing
the
folk
little song
yeah. about Piet
the
Hein.
The Silver Fleet, yeah.
Yes, a yeah. lot of fun for us.
Yeah, sure. What do you do otherwise? Social media?
Sure. We have a very active Facebook page. Mm-hmm. We have a blog as well. We do all sorts of programs that get quite a lot of attention. We were actually, I don't know, we were in the New York Daily News last week. right now we're doing African-American and Afro-Dutch programming along with the exhibit.
And what does the programming consist of?
Well, we're doing a three-part series of called Crailo Fest, and we're really focusing on the culture in the communities that's current that really harkens back to Africa, the west coast of Africa.
So you mean drawing connections somehow?
For sure.
Can you give
with
an example
with gospel
of that?
Singing,
oh,
stringed instruments, dance, all mm-hmm. sorts of creative programming. We have an Afro-Dutch historian, cook, food historian coming on June 11th, Lavada Nahan, and she will be cooking on our open hearth in the kitchen cellar here. We will also have the Children of Dahomey coming next spring for Pinkster Fest. So, yes, we're doing all sorts of unusual programming that hasn't been done here before.
And do things take place outside in the garden, or do you do things
both
on the river on that side?
We do. That's our park across the river. And whenever we have a festival type event that's filled with tents and activity, on June 4th, we'll have our third Kralo Fest in the park.
And finally, well, let's end with the future. What are your plans, objectives, dreams?
Sure. Well, we've always wanted to do a historical exhibit on Kralo, just to actually, as you said very well, unpack all of that history for people, because it is difficult to sort out. And we have some nice artifacts to support that history. And hopefully that won't be too far in the future. The Dishonorable Trade exhibit is a traveling one, and that will begin traveling to universities, museums, libraries, and the city hall. The mayor wants it for the Albany City Hall in 2017, probably the summer of 2017.
This has been wonderful. Thank you very much.
Sure. You're very welcome. Thank
Heidi
you.
Hill, we're at the Kralo State Historic Site. And thank you once again.
Thank you, Russell.